If you're following the lines between us, you may have noticed a particular arc to the issues we're exploring. First, we looked into equality of opportunity. Where is the opportunity in our region, and where is it not? Why can you cross a street in Baltimore, say York Road, and just know that things are going to turn out differently for most of the children who live there? It turns out decades of housing policy and private lending practices helped segregate our region by race and class. Here's UMBC American Studies professor Ed Orser from our third episode, talking about a real estate practice in the 1960s that pressured white families to sell cheap when a black family moved onto the block, then sold the house to a black family at a high markup.
Black purchasers very often could not get loans through mainstream banks, so only could get the loan to buy the house through the Blockbuster or through the agent. Nobody called themselves a Blockbuster, by the way. Their defense was they were making housing available where they had been totally excluded.
We looked back on the whole century, from redlining to subprime lending. We talked to the people whose lives these practices affected, including an African-American World War II veteran who bought a house in Baltimore 63 years ago. Now, his great-niece wants to help him sell it to help pay for his assisted living costs. But the neighborhoods available to black homebuyers back then haven't appreciated like those in the suburbs.
We just received a short sale offer for $11,000. That offer was rejected by the bank. I literally received an email yesterday for $20,000. It's just the ghetto, short and simple.
Then we spent several weeks asking what's helping people to get good jobs and what obstacles Baltimore job seekers are facing. We talked to West Baltimore resident Amber Jones. She was a student at Towson University, but she took some time off, in part because of a frustrating bus commute. She's hoping to save up and buy a car.
I remember that I had an advisor who was trying to get me to take a 9 a.m. class, and I was insisting that it was too early, and she didn't really seem to understand until I explained to her that it could take me about 2 hours to get to campus from my house, which by car would only be about 20 minutes away.
So far, we've been telling stories from our region, how inequality plays out here. But there's an aspect of inequality that reaches far beyond Maryland's borders. It may have come across your radar around the fall of 2011. Income inequality. The rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. Activists pitched tents in the downtowns of major cities, and suddenly it seemed everyone in America was talking about inequality. Now that we've laid out the regional dynamics of the disparities we see every day, we're going to step back and look at their national and global roots. First, I want to give you a picture of what income inequality looks like here in Maryland. Maryland's income inequality numbers are just below the national average, but it's growing. The official measure of income inequality in Maryland has gone up 34% since 1968. Income inequality is highest in Wicomico County and Baltimore City. It's lowest in Calvert and Charles counties. What drives income inequality? Some say tax policy. Inequality goes up if taxes hit the poor harder, and it goes down if the rich bear a greater tax burden. You may remember income tax rates being raised on high earners here last spring.
We will be moving forward with a revenue package that will call upon about 16% of us who are in the top earning brackets of our state to pay a little more, and that's the primary revenue measure that will be adopted here.
That was Governor Martin O'Malley on WBAL Radio last May. Another driver of income inequality is capital income, how much money people make from their investments, interest, dividends, or sales of investments like stocks and houses. In Maryland, the percentage of income coming from investments is way up compared to other sources of income, and that can bump up income inequality because it's mostly rich people who make their money that way. The fiscal cliff deal Congress passed in January raised capital gains taxes, which are levied on this kind of income. That could potentially decrease income inequality. Here's Brian Dees from the National Economic Council.
Going forward, people making over $250,000 will pay about a 19% on their capital gains and dividend income, and people making over $450,000 will pay about a 24% rate.
The other kind of income that can affect inequality is regular old wages. President Obama wants Congress to raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, and in Maryland there's a push in the General Assembly to bump the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10. There is also pushback from legislators who say that would kill jobs. Add it all up, and the proportion of all the income in Maryland that's in the wallets of the richest 20% has grown since 1980. It shrank for everyone else. In 2000, the poorest 20% of Marylanders had 4% of the income, and the richest 20% had 47% of the income. Advocates on the left say there are steps that states can take to reduce income inequality, for instance, raising the minimum wage, or extending unemployment insurance, or making state income tax systems more progressive. Some on the right say there are better ways to measure who's doing well and who's not. Will Wilkerson is a research fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He says if you look at consumption, what we buy, there's less difference between how well the rich and poor are doing. His argument says what we buy means more for our well-being than how many dollars are in our wallets. Food, for instance, has become cheaper, which helps the poor. And there's even less difference between the rich and the poor when you ask them how happy they are. You still can't buy happiness, but you can measure it. At a November symposium on inequality held in Massachusetts, Wilkinson said income inequality itself is irrelevant.
What I think we need to do is look at America's institutions very closely and try to find the injustice and wrongdoing in those institutions, whether or not that has an effect on the dispersion of incomes.
For the last 4 months, we've been doing just that, looking at institutions. Now we are going to look at income inequality for a few weeks. We'll start with the middle class, or rather, what's left of it.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. Middle-class neighborhoods are disappearing in America, according to recent research. In 1970, two-thirds of families lived in middle-income neighborhoods. By 2007, that had slipped to 44%. And meanwhile, the proportion of poor neighborhoods and the proportion of rich neighborhoods has doubled. It's called income segregation. And one of the researchers behind those numbers, Stanford University education and sociology professor Sean Reardon, joins us from Stanford to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
And here with me in the studio is Jennifer Arndt Robinson. She's been a homeowner in the neighborhood around Patterson Park for 12 years, a neighborhood that has seen several shifts in median income over the last few decades. Thanks for coming to Charles Village.
I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. Now, Sean Reardon, how did you determine which neighborhoods are poor, which are affluent, which fall in between?
Well, we defined their relative affluence relative to the metropolitan area. So if a metropolitan area had a sort of median family income of, say, $75,000, we called neighborhoods that were between, say, $60,000 and $90,000 median income, that is where most of the families in those neighborhoods had incomes in that range, we called those kind of middle-income neighborhoods. And then neighborhoods that had most of the people much higher or much lower than the metropolitan average, say 50% higher or 50% lower median incomes than the average, we called those either very poor or very affluent. So it's a relative term.
And where does Baltimore rank in income segregation?
So I looked at the numbers to refresh my memory this morning. I think Baltimore is currently somewhere around 18th in terms of the 100 largest metropolitan areas. So it's quite at the high end of segregation. Back in 1970, I think it was ranked in the mid-30s.
More segregated in terms of income than it was
That's right.
A few decades ago. And Sean, I imagine some of our listeners are thinking, duh, I already know there is a lot of income inequality in America, and so there are fewer middle-class families, so of course there are fewer middle-class neighborhoods. I mean, is that a summary of what you found, or is it more than that?
It's more than that, but that is the right next question to ask. Is this just because we have more income inequality and so there's more rich and more poor families and therefore more rich and poor neighborhoods? That's part of why we see this happening. But we also see that even in places where income inequality didn't change much, the average high-income family is much less likely now to live in a neighborhood with middle-class families or low-income families than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And likewise, for poor-income families, less likely to live in those mixed-income neighborhoods than they were 30 or 40 years ago, even in places where income inequality didn't change.
Jennifer Robinson, in 2001, you bought a house near the corner of Elwood and Baltimore Streets.
That's right.
And moved in by yourself.
Yes.
What was your block like then?
My block was a really interesting place to be. We had many abandoned homes. We had a lot of diversity on the block. We had some homeowners. We had some renters. I came in at a time when it was very racially diverse, but there were a lot of kind of issues in terms of active drug dealing on the street, trash. So it was definitely taking a risk. I was told not to buy north of Baltimore Street at the time.
Were you an oddball in terms of being higher income?
Well, I bought through the Patterson Park CDC, which was trying to bring middle-income people back into the neighborhood, which had been struggling with the loss of population. So I was, in some ways, an anomaly at the beginning. Certainly, as somebody who came in, I paid more for my house than a lot of the houses had been traditionally valued at. And I saw it as an investment. I bought a completely rehabbed row home that I was able to afford and take care of, but still that was at a level that might have been different than some of my neighbors at the time.
And 12 years on, mm-hmm. since then, are there more people like you demographically on the block?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm no longer on that block. One of the things that happened was I met my husband, and he moved in with me, and we had the conversation about where we were going to live our lives together. And we decided that the neighborhood was really key to us, and we decided to stay in the neighborhood. So we've since moved to a different block in the same neighborhood. But I can say that block on Elwood probably looks different than it did at the time. There are many fewer vacant homes. I don't know that any of the homes on that block are vacant at this time. There's been a lot of investment in the homes that were vacant. So there are a lot of people living there. Couples and families have moved in and made investments in that block, I know.
This is Maryland Morning, The Lines Between Us on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Jennifer Arndt Robinson, a resident of the Patterson Park area, and Sean Reardon, a sociology professor at Stanford University. Sean, the kind of picture, Jennifer's story, is really what you did not find overall in your research, right?
Right. I mean, certainly most every city, to some extent, has some neighborhoods that have undergone some of the kinds of changes that Jennifer describes, and those are often kind of vibrant, exciting, interesting neighborhoods to live in for residents of all socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. But overwhelmingly, those are relatively small islands in a kind of much larger sea of increasing segregation. And so while I think it's great to sort of understand how interesting and how those kinds of neighborhoods work and are changing and are kind of retaining their diversity, we shouldn't mistake the fact that some neighborhoods like that exist for sort of an overall success story of kind of increasing integration socioeconomically.
Yeah, I want to pick up on you use the phrase increasing segregation, but you're talking about income segregation, not necessarily racial segregation, correct?
Right. I mean, one of the interesting stories over the last 40 years in America is that racial segregation in terms of where people live has actually declined modestly over the last 40 years. We're more likely to live with neighbors of a different racial or ethnic background than we were 40 years ago, but less likely to live with neighbors of a different socioeconomic background.
Does that alarm you, Sean?
Well, I think there are reasons to worry about what that means for American society. I mean, one reason is that I think in a democracy, it's really important to be able to understand and empathize with people of different backgrounds, whether that's racial backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, what have you. And to the extent that we're more segregated on some of those lines, I think that poses some challenges for the sort of democratic understanding that's necessary. I also worry that, you know, people like to invest in their local community because they can see that it will have benefits for them, for their children, and so on. And so when the people with most of the money live in neighborhoods very different than everyone else, they, like the rest of us, would like to invest in the neighborhoods where their children are going to grow up. But what that means is that there's less of that kind of investment, whether you think of it as public investment or private investment. Think of parks and schools and police forces and all of that. That less of that's going to sort of spill over to benefit the middle class or the working class or the poor because they're investing in sort of isolated neighborhoods far away from everyone else.
Jennifer, it sounds as if the pieces of the puzzle that Sean is putting together are sort of conspiring to push you out.
And they haven't, because the other piece of the puzzle for us is that we've got a lot of organizations that are working both locally in our community, but also through the region and the city that have developed, I think, over the last 10 years that really support the idea that this is a community for all people. You know, the Friends of Patterson Park, Banner Neighborhoods, Patterson Park Community Development Corporation, I could go on and name. The Downtown Baltimore Family Alliance is doing great work trying to keep the resources and help people find what they need throughout the city so that city life is a really viable option for families. My husband and I have a year-old daughter, and we certainly ask the question all the time, you know, is this the right place for us? And we know that for us, the community is really the priority, and the connections that we have and the ability to be involved and to kind of be part of this movement is something that we really value much more than, you know, a bigger house or a yard or, you know, parking in a garage.
But you say you've asked yourself that question.
I do.
You've found an answer. What about your neighbors?
Yeah, we're seeing a real shift, I think. When I moved into the neighborhood in 2001, there were very few children in the neighborhood. You didn't see 3 or 4 year olds because people who came maybe with the same intentions that I had kids and decided that it was time to move, or they, you know, their children reached school age and it was time to move out. And what we're seeing right now is a real baby boom in our neighborhood. It's really exciting. We have a year old daughter and we have several friends who have children, babies, and we've made the decision to stay, and they've made it too. And we all ask each other the question, you know, when somebody announces they're pregnant, are you staying? And that's a real consideration, and we just find that more and more people are making the choice to stay.
Is it a decision that works for a toddler but doesn't work when school
is on the horizon? We see that changing, actually. We have the conversation about schools on a regular basis, and we see options. We see charter schools in our neighborhood. We see charter schools in other areas. We think it's going to be okay. We see ourselves in our house for 20 years, and I think our friends and neighbors do as well, and that's a commitment that we're making.
Sean Reardon, your research, as I understand, was the first to look at this income segregation in the 21st century. You brought the data as up to date as you could. And do you see any deceleration of this trend?
No, actually, it's the opposite. We, in the report that I think you referred to, we had data that went through about 2007. And since then, we've gotten 2 more years of data from the American Community Survey. And it looks like the trend is actually accelerating slightly, though it's a little bit hard to tell on an annual basis. But there's no evidence that it's slowing down. So that's sort of troublesome. I mean, I applaud people who go against this sort of tide, like Jennifer. My brother lives in a neighborhood in Boston that's much like the one she describes. And they have children who are in elementary school in the neighborhood school. And there are challenges, but it's also really exciting for them to be part of a neighborhood that's very diverse and very sort of a lot of people talking about how to make the neighborhood better. And so on the one hand, we have those stories. And then on the other hand, we have these sort of, when you step back and look at the 20,000 sort of foot picture, that the overwhelming trend is the other direction. And so I think we need to learn from the sort of success stories in these neighborhoods, like the one Jennifer describes, to show that it's possible to have both really interesting, diverse neighborhoods and good schools and safety and things like that.
I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jennifer Robinson lives in Patterson Park. Sean Reardon is a sociology professor at Stanford University. The study we've been discussing is part of US 2010, a research project financed by the Russell Sage Foundation and Brown University. And Sean kindly sent along maps that show neighborhood income levels across our region from 1970 to the present. We made an animated map out of them. You can literally watch middle-class neighborhoods vanish and the poor and affluent neighborhoods replace them. It's at linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
If you look at our animated map of neighborhood income levels, you can see middle-income neighborhoods vanishing from most of the city. The northeast corner seems to be holding on just a bit more tightly to its middle-class status, but things could go either way. What will it take to remain middle-class? And what does middle-class mean to the people who live there? Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan picked two census tracts around the Hamilton neighborhood and went to visit this week.
I was born and raised in Baltimore. I love my city. I wear it on my sleeve. Anybody that know me can tell you I love Baltimore to death.
That's 39-year-old Demetric Farmer. I caught up with him in front of his house on Century Road, up a steep hill from Bel Air Road, as he was getting out of his car. He'd just finished a 5:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. shift at a city transfer station.
I always like envision myself buying a home, and I said, you know, welcome to the middle class, but people tell me, no, you're not middle class, you're just one paycheck from being broke.
When we zoomed in on those two census tracts on our neighborhood income maps, we noticed that one has remained low to middle income since 1970. The other, where Demetric Farmer lives, slipped from high middle income down to poor.
I think it's all about perception. I mean, where do you think you land on the chart? I don't know. I don't know. Sometimes you tell somebody if you make 40 grand, they might like, no, you're not middle class. But I would say the middle class, you know, far as salary range concerned, probably would start at around about 45 on up.
Farmer bought his row house in 2010 when he was working for a carpet cleaning company. He's feeling more middle class lately. When he took that job with the city's Bureau of Solid Waste last year, it was a bump up in pay for him. The data says that this part of Hamilton is poor, at least compared to the median income around the region. But this newcomer says his quiet street is a blessing and a move up.
People in general just, you know, you tell them what neighborhood you live in, they're like, I don't think so. But it's all about perception, what you think. So I really believe it's middle class to me. And I'm, like I said, I'm happy to live in this neighborhood.
Hamilton resident Sheila Ebeline loves her neighborhood too. So much so that she's become president of the Glenham Belhar Community Association, which represents the two census tracts we looked at in Baltimore's northeast corner. But if Demetric Farmer feels like he's moving up, Ebeline is worried about slipping down.
I would call ourselves the struggling middle class.
She and her husband bought their house from the estate of his grandfather, who had the house built back in the 50s. So they've seen the changes of the past few decades.
You look at the neighborhood and you look at the people that used to live in this neighborhood or other neighborhoods that were middle class. You look at Bethlehem Steel. What's happened to them? What's happened to the car industry? They were well-paying jobs that offered entry-level non-skilled workers opportunities to learn a skill and to obtain a solid salary or hourly rate with healthcare benefits, etc. So, vapor. We are a snapshot of what is happening in America. Things are becoming very polar, and the middle class is shrinking.
The people on Sheila's block in her husband's grandfather's day had jobs with BGE and the city and federal governments.
It was a good, healthy mix of high-earning blue-collar and maybe low-earning white-collar. You know, solidly middle-class.
Today, she says the mix of jobs is similar, maybe a little less white-collar.
My husband works in a white-collar job, but he's on the low end of the earning scale, and with our expenses, that brings us down to blue-collar level.
But there's a difference, she says, between her husband's grandfather's Hamilton and hers. Those middle-class salaries just don't go as far.
The economy, what they have to spend and the amount that they have to work.
Her neighbors are clinging tightly to whatever work they have, worried they won't find another job.
I mean, I know several people in the neighborhood that have a second job. Well, believe it or not, my husband, who has an MBA and works at NASA, actually took a second job for a while at Walmart as a cashier. There are other people who will take a weekend job at some place that's clerical or whatever. Everybody's trying to supplement their income with something else.
Another difference she's noticed in Hamilton these days is that there are fewer children around. She understands. When her son and daughter were toddlers back in the 1990s, her family, despite some financial turmoil, still had options.
One was picking up and moving to the county. Another one was private education. The third was public education. And I had been watching the standardized test scores just fall and fall and fall at the school that she would have been attending, at the public school.
That school was across the street from her daughter's preschool program.
And I would park along the street and listen to the children who were being dismissed. And I was really upset to find that there was a lot of profanity and disruptive behavior.
Sheila grew up in East Baltimore and went to parochial school. Her husband had gone to public school just across the county line in Parkville. He resisted the private school option.
So one day, when I was picking up Elise in the spring from her preschool program, I had him come with me and I just put the windows of the car down. And he almost like had a heart attack and fell in the street. And he went, wait a minute. And I said, these are children that are K through 8. And he just was shocked.
Parochial school it was. But many of her neighbors take the county option.
What I've seen over the past 20 years will be an individual move in. They'll invest money in their house. It'll look fantastic. They'll be great neighbors. They'll either get married or enter into a relationship. Many times after that, they will have a small child. And somewhere between age 2 and 4, the for sale sign will go up.
To this community association president, whether a middle-class neighborhood can remain middle-class isn't just about the jobs the adults have. It's about the bonds that they form when they come together around their children's activities and schooling. Sheila Ebeline's children are now 18. She and her husband are proud to have raised them in Northeast Baltimore. They just wish more parents felt they could do the same.
Maryland Morning Senior Producer Lawrence Lanahan. That's it for The Lines Between Us today. We hope you'll take a look at our animated neighborhood income map. It's at linesbetweenus.org. We also hope you'll tell us your story. Would you move to a more affluent neighborhood if you could? Why? Or why not? Tell us at linesbetweenus.org or leave a voicemail we can use on air or online at 410-881-3162. Again, that's 410-881-3162. Also at linesbetweenus.org, Lawrence Lanahan's essay about income inequality in Maryland that aired earlier this morning during Morning Edition. On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stick around. In just a bit, Tom Hall's going to help the Maryland Historical Society solve the mystery of a very strange photograph they found in their archives.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus, or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.